And coming up next, we're going to listen to a Palestinian woman describe real-life hunger games.
Israel is targeting everybody in Gaza. Nobody is safe. This is real-life Hunger Games. This is a real-life Squid Game. This is a real-life Black Mirror episode. But unfortunately, it's people's lives that are at stake. It's not just a TV show. It's not just a movie. You can't turn it off. It's not a fiction. It's real life. The ratio of killing in Gaza of civilians is significantly higher than the average civilian toll in all conflicts around the world during the 20th century. So what we're seeing in Gaza is unprecedented killing at unprecedented rates using unprecedented technology. We know that Israel is relying on AI technology to identify more targets than they've ever been able to identify in a shorter amount of time, which is what explains the scope of the destruction and devastation and the killing that we have seen in Gaza. An investigation was published by 972 magazine entitled The Mass Assassination Factory. And that investigation relied on the testimonies of current and former Israeli intelligence officials who were quoted as confirming that Israel intentionally targets Palestinian family homes and apartment buildings in its airstrikes, and that this is not an accident. Our families are not collateral damage, rather they are the targets of Israel's attack on purpose. Israel refers to those targets as power targets. And this is an intentional policy that is designed to create as much carnage as possible, to create as much despair and devastation as possible. In the words of the Israeli intelligence officers describing this practice, it's intended to put pressure on Hamas by putting pressure on the entire civilian population. This practice meets the definition of terrorism. Terrorism is specifically unlawful targeting of civilians using violence for a political purpose. But of course, this is never dealt with in the mainstream media. It's also never dealt with by the government officials who are arming and financing this genocide. So a few days after the Mass Assassination Factory investigation was published, Matthew Miller of the U.S. State Department was questioned whether he believed Israel was intentionally targeting civilians. And he replied, "I have not seen any evidence that Israel is intentionally targeting civilians." Now, am I to believe that I have more information about what Israel is doing in Gaza than the U.S. State Department? That's an insane premise, because this was a public report which was published just days prior. And yet the U.S. lives in this fictional reality which it has created, which enables it to ignore clear evidence, videos, photos, testimonies coming out from on the ground by Palestinians who are living this genocide. Part of Israel's dystopian reality is the way that it uses technology to oppress Palestinians and to carry out this genocide. So we've seen Israel use drones to send threatening messages to Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. We've seen them use other types of drones that have a very disruptive and disturbing buzzing sound, and those drones fly over Gaza at all times to make Palestinians think that an airstrike is impending, but in reality it's just the sound of the drone, which is entire purpose is to fill the sky with buzzing sounds and to create fear in the Palestinian society. We've also seen Israel employ tactics whereby it drops leaflets telling Palestinians that they must evacuate, but evacuate to where, it's unclear, because we know that everywhere Israel has told Palestinians to evacuate has also been bombed and not spared from the brutality of Israeli airstrikes. We've seen Israel rely on QR technology telling Palestinians that their neighborhoods have now been divided into numbered quarters and that it will announce which numbers are going to be airstriked and that Palestinians should evacuate from one numbered area to another numbered area. But it does so at a time when they're also cutting communications so that Palestinians can't even access this very twisted technology. But even if they do, again, they're not spared and they are targeted. So it's really just to create this impression that Israel's providing a safe outlet for Palestinians. But the reality is that nowhere is safe, and that everywhere that Israel has told Palestinians to go during this genocide has not been spared and has been subject to airstrike. The weapons that are being used in Gaza are the most advanced weapons in existence. And in many cases, they're being tested on Gaza's civilian population, being used for the very first time. And we know also that once those weapons have been tested on Gazan civilians, they then can be sold to governments around the world with the label battle tested. And that also increases their value. All of this is, of course, dystopian. There's no other word for it. Especially when you remember that 1 million children live in Gaza, that they are half of the population, and that while they are being bombarded with the most advanced weapons known to man, they are also being starved and dehydrated and succumbing to disease all at the same time. I don't think there's any way for us to really understand the totality of the scope of the human suffering in Gaza right now. Every form of human suffering that could possibly exist exists right now in Gaza. All of it. Starvation, dehydration, the sounds of the bombs, the sounds of the drones. You've never had a day of quiet. The smells, everything smells like death. Everything smells like burning, toxic gas. There's no fresh air, there's no clean air. Everything smells like rotting flesh and blood. The sights, everywhere you go, there's destruction. Everywhere you go, concrete and iron and blood and destroyed buildings and destroyed homes and destroyed businesses. The way that people must live in their bodies in this moment, pure anxiety, depression, shock, PTSD that never ends. The feeling, you know, if you're injured in these airstrikes, the amount of pain, the agony, the inability to find any relief, there's no medicine, there's no anesthesia. We heard reports of pregnant women being forced to give birth via cesarean section with no anesthesia. My brother-in-law's cousin recently gave birth, and he described her birth scene as her giving birth on the floor of a UN school where there was no electricity and there was only a flashlight and an iPhone light to guide the individuals helping her. When you think about all of it, you realize that there isn't an ounce of relief anywhere in Gaza, and that everybody's senses are being bombarded with different forms of torture at all times. It's so essential in this moment to center Palestinian voices. We are credible narrators of our own lived experience, and unfortunately, the corporate media does not allow us to present our lived experiences to the world and to contextualize our realities. That's why it's so important to support alternative media that does give Palestinians a platform, amplifies their voice, and allows them to tell their stories. Join the future of journalism. Join Double Down News on Patreon.
Next, we have the opinion of independent presidential candidate Cornel West on Gaza.
Netanyahu, you know, he's the Trump of Israel, just like Trump is the Netanyahu of America. They're both consistent gangsters.
Dr. Cornel West is one of America's most prominent scholars and activists. He's written over a dozen books and taught at some of the country's most prestigious universities. And now he's running for president as an independent, and he joins us to talk Gaza, Biden, and the US elections. Dr. Cornel West, thank you so much for joining us on Real Talk Online.
No, thank you, my dear brother. Appreciate the coming conversation.
How do you define the US government's Gaza policy currently?
You know, it reminds me in many ways of Vietnam in the times of Martin Luther King Jr., Stokely Carmichael, and Diane Nash, that Gaza is a historic turning point in the American empire.
A historic turning point, you're saying?
That's right. Historic, pivotal point in the history of the American empire. Very much like the Algerian War with the French Empire between 1954 and 62. Very much like the Suez Canal in 1956, vis-a-vis the British Empire. The American Empire is in the process of deep decline and decay. And what Gaza does is rip the veil and reveal an American criminality, an American hypocrisy, an American immorality that's been parading as this force for democracy and force for freedom around the world. Now, of course, so many brothers and sisters, especially in the global South, have seen this before, given all of the U.S. supports of the coups. We've seen it in Iran. We've seen it in Guatemala. We've seen it in Grenada. We've seen it in so many other places, overthrowing democratic governments. But the whole world now sees in real time immeasurable, indescribable suffering of our precious Palestinian brothers and sisters, with genocidal assaults, with ethnic cleansing, and the apartheid conditions, so that Israel, as a satellite of the American empire, becomes the mediating force to reveal to the world the American criminality. Now, of course, it's also Israeli criminality as well. But for the most part, it could not proceed without American money, without American bombs, without American military support, and without American cover at the United Nations.
Well, if I bring it to what's happening on in the political climate today and on the U.S. front, recently when Kamala Harris was asked if, you know, U.S. aid to Israel would be used as leverage, she said we mustn't conflate between the Israeli people and the Israeli government, which sends a message that, you know, that the U.S. wouldn't use aid as some sort of leverage. How do you see that?
Well, it's not even a question of the aid or not. Just look at how morally bankrupt the U.S. policy is in terms of creating a port on the one hand, and you're providing billions and billions of dollars to facilitate and enable the genocide on the other. Why? Because you won't confront the right-wing Jewish elites who are themselves making the decision to pursue the genocide, but America creates a condition for that pursuit. And so Kamala Harris and the others would have to acknowledge, and I've said this on many occasions, their particular policy makes them war criminals. And there's no way you can attenuate your war criminality by providing humanitarian aid. No, you've got to shatter the conditions for the very possibility of the genocide. You don't allow the genocide and then come in with some charity. No, not at all. Not at all. It's the larger framework that needs to be examined. And I tell you this, my brother, at a very deeper moral level, because I speak also as one coming out of the revolutionary black Christian tradition of Martin King and Fannie Lou Hamer. The fundamental problem of Washington's imperial policies is that they really do not believe that a Palestinian life and a Palestinian baby has the same value as a Jewish life and a Jewish baby.
You don't think
because
they see it that way?
If this would happen, they don't see it that way because their assumptions are so deep, but everybody knows and the whole world knows. If there were a Palestinian genocidal assault on Jews and Jewish babies were being killed at the level and intensity that Palestinian babies were being killed, the U.S. government have a qualitatively different policy. In fact, the U.S. government would support the Jewish version of Hamas because, you know, U.S. government has a history of supporting various groups that kill innocent people when they conform with U.S. foreign interests. So you can see when there's white babies or Jewish babies, we have one response. When there's Palestinian babies or brown babies or black babies, we have another response. So there's a racist element here. And that needs to be pointed out, and that would be also part of a West administration telling the truth. The condition of truth is to allow suffering to speak, my brother.
Well, I guess the obvious question here, Dr. West, is, well, what would you be doing if you were in the White House in this situation?
Oh, if I was in the White House, first I'd have to tell the American people and the world the truth. I'd have to tell the truth going back to 1970 with the Balfour Declaration and the British Empire providing this particular land for Jewish people. Now, Jewish people themselves have been terrorized and traumatized. There's no, and hated for 2,000 years. There's no doubt about that. That was a European greed and hatred. And Jews jumped out of those burning buildings of Europe and landed on the backs of Arabs. And they told lies. They said there was nobody there. They said there was no people there. That's not true. There were hundreds and thousands of people there, and they had to choose to coexist or dominate, and they opted for Jabotinsky. And, of course, Netanyahu's father was an assistant for Jabotinsky. Jabotinsky said what? We must dominate and, if possible, annihilate these people. Well, see, that's sick. That is as fascist as you can get. And so the American people need to know the truth. Then you move to policy. Mm. And you say, that's why we're going to end the occupations. We're going to end the siege. We're going to stop the war. We're going to make sure that we do all we can to ensure that there is Palestinian dignity and equality, as well as Jewish security and safety. We don't want the annihilation, and we don't want the massacre of any peoples, no matter who they are. But we are not going to sit back and somehow think that you can have a security and safety of Jews on the necks of Palestinians. There's going to be equality and dignity across the board, and we're going to come together and come up with ways in which we can achieve that. That's what you would hear in a West administration.
Hmm. And if we bring it to Biden's recent comments, Dr. West, I mean, he said that he has a red line when it comes to Israel invading Rafah. Yeah, in the same interview, he said that he would also never leave Israel. Now, that's contradicting or confusing at best, don't you think?
Well, he's made it clear he has no red line. You know, he's just talking. He's just talking. I mean, he is the candidate who has received over $100 million from AIPAC. AIPAC is the lobby that ensures that congressmen and presidents and others will defer to Israeli policy. He's been at that for decades, so he doesn't really have a red line at all. What he's concerned about is the election. He's got myself and others coming at him directly with what? With the truth, with the love of people, including the love of Palestinian people. Mm. With what? People waking up and seeing his, not just his hypocrisy, but his criminality.
That's what I wanted to get at. Why did you call him a war criminal? Why do you call him a war criminal?
Because what is taking place right now in Gaza is not just a war crime and a crime against humanity. It is a crime of genocide.
But he would disagree with you, Dr. West. I mean, he even just said in his recent interview, he basically refused to concede that it was a widely shared sentiment that what's happening in Israel, in Gaza, is genocide.
Well, I mean, we got the International Court of justice that's already against him, and I don't even believe it's just a matter of the court. That if you see for yourself, based on the definition of genocide, which is the wholesale attack on the part or the whole of a group that undermines the condition of their living, from health care to food, starvation as weapon against them and so forth, that is genocide. And even people want to argue whether it's genocide or not, it's such a indescribable crime against humanity that even the semantic debate is a distraction. And he has no deep sense of urgency, no sense of emergency about it. It's just a particular electoral political calculation that he makes. That's what upsets me about not just him, all of these Democrats who are enabling genocide. Each and every one of them, from the House, the Senate, the State House, the City Council. If you can't meet this moral test, it's clear that you have hardly any moral fiber in you as human beings. Now, as politicians, you can play the electoral game. But I come from a black folk. We were played the electoral game for over 200 and some years in American democracy. All the fashionable liberal politicians couldn't say a word about lynching. They couldn't even pass a lynching bill in the history of America. It began in 1901, and they finally passed it a few years ago. That's sick, my brother. That's true with my indigenous brothers and sisters here. And that's why this is the Malcolm X moment. The chickens are coming home to roost for the American empire. The chickens are coming home to roost for American democracy. You are going to reap what you sow sooner or later, truth crushed to earth shall rise again. Lies hiding crimes cannot live forever. This is what we're experiencing right now. And you see it among the younger generation across the board, black, white, red. You see it among our Jewish brothers and sisters. And if not now, and Jewish Voices for Peace. And you certainly see it among Muslims and Arabs in the United States. And of course, we've got our own critique of the Arab countries not having a sense of emergency and urgency here as well.
Sure. I'm going to get to the Arab American vote in a second, but I wanted to just to get your opinion on how you've been seeing Netanyahu's reactions to Biden's criticisms. I mean, he's been basically doubling down and rejecting any of Biden's criticisms publicly.
Well, no, see, Netanyahu, you know, he's the Trump of Israel, just like Trump is the Netanyahu of America. They're both consistent gangsters. You see, they don't pander. You see, so Netanyahu said up front, look, I am going to pursue this genocidal war, period. And then he's got his talking points. We're going to kill all of Hamas so that 13,000 children, each one of them is a shield for Hamas. You see how sick that is? You see how ridiculous and ludicrous that is? But that's his talking point, and he follows through. So he has a consistency in his criminality and his gangster activity. Trump is the same way within the bounds of the American empire. It's Biden and others who want to act like they're so concerned.
I mean, Biden was caught saying that he'll have a come to Jesus meeting with Netanyahu soon in a hot mic. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
If he can't have a come to Jesus meeting after 10 innocent children are killed, let alone 13,000 are killed, you know that he's just talking. He's a hypocrite. He's not honest. He'll say almost anything to win votes.
Well, speaking of votes, let's talk about the Arab American vote. I mean, Biden's approval ratings, they went from 59% in 2020 to 17% in 2023 last year amongst the Arab American community. And, you know, obviously there's reports that he's going to face challenges in three battleground states, Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania. How do you see this play out with the Arab American vote?
Well, he's not going to gain any significant Muslim or Arab American vote. There's no doubt about that. And no matter what he does, it's too late. It's too little, too late. There's too many precious Palestinians who have been not just murdered but maimed, and even Palestinians who are alive. You know, what kind of lives are we talking about in the rubble, in the ruins? Let's be very, very honest about this. So that the very notion that somehow he can do X or Y as a way of responding to an electoral constituency whose grandmothers and grandfathers and mothers of fathers are being systematically murdered. You see, that there's nothing he can do, and understandably so. And I think part of the problem is that he's incapable, it seems, of really casting this in a serious moral and spiritual framework. It's only tactical in regard to election. And that in and of itself is an insult to anybody, let alone Arabs and Muslims, to view the killings of our family members as just another moment for electoral political calculation.
Right. And is this why you said, Dr. West, is this why you said that the Democrats, they see Muslims and Arabs in the U.S. as interest groups?
That's right. But that's why they're beyond redemption. But this is what happens when empires begin to implode. And the willful blindnesses that they have render them actually contributing to their own destruction. And that's very much where we are as an empire. The whole world sees it, but on the inside, you've been to the country, you see, my God, the level of homelessness, the levels of poverty. They say the economy is doing so well, so well, yet three individuals have wealth equivalent to 160 million people. Three individuals have wealth equivalent to 50% of the American citizenry, and yet you got all these pundits talking about how beautiful the economy is. You see, that kind of ideological cover is just as bad in some ways as the vetoes of the resolutions in the United Nations when you're calling for humanitarian aid of people undergoing genocide.
So you're saying the media has a role as well. The media is also complicit in your view.
Oh, a major role, my brother, a major role. They're supposed to be involved in truth-telling. Hmm. Where's the outrage when the Palestinian journalists or the progressive Israeli journalists who were killed, who were lied on? Where's the outrage for Julian Assange as a journalist exposing the lies of the American empire? And of course, we haven't even got to the great Mumia Abdul-Jamal and the great H.R.A.P. Brown or Amin Jamal Abdullah Al-Hamin and so forth, you see. So that we have to just be honest. And it's very difficult to be honest because it takes bravery and courage. And most of our politicians are cowards, man. They're in a system of legalized bribery and normalized corruption. They're well adjusted to an unjust status quo. They don't want to tell the truth. They don't want to straighten their backs up and pursue justice. And what does that mean? Well, it means for me, they are slapping Martin Luther King Jr. in the face in the grave. Yeah. And that for me is not just sacrilegious, but that is an undermining of the best of not just America. It's an undermining of the best of the human spirit.
And you have written so much about race relations, particularly in the U.S., Dr. West. And I wanted to ask you about this. I mean, how have you been seeing Gaza play out in the African-American communities in America?
Well, it's been a very, very sad affair in terms of black voices being too scared and intimidated to actually call for not just a ceasefire, but the end for occupation. So much of black organizations and black leaders themselves have been shaped by either AIPAC or being shaped by big influence, by big money, by big title that doesn't allow them to speak from the depths of their moral souls, which is another way of saying we've got sellout. We've got folk who have given up in serious truth-telling in order to preserve their positions. And this is true not just in government, it's true across the board. And so the black freedom struggle has always been the leaven in the American loaf. You see, it's always been the expander and the enabler in American democracy. Once you have so much black leadership that is intimidated and scared and afraid, then the black freedom movement itself becomes weaker. And if it becomes weaker, it's no accident that democratic forces as a whole become weaker. Now, there's other democratic forces, which is beautiful. We talked about that before. The young people, the Arabs, the Muslims, and so forth. And there's a gender element here, too. I think the women of different colors have been much, much stronger than the men of different colors. But I'm simply here as a candidate to say that I come from a great black people who produce love warriors in the face of hatred, who produce freedom fighters in the face of U.S. terrorism, of lynching and Jim Crow and Jane Crow, and of wounded healers in the face of trauma. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to hold up that bloodstained banner, which means I'm in deep solidarity with oppressed people around the world. And yes, that includes my precious Palestinian brothers and sisters in Gaza.
And you've also been critical of African Americans in power. So what do you make of, you know, current African Americans who hold public office right now? I mean, I think of Linda Thomas Greenfield, who's become the face of the U.S. veto at the Security Council, the U.N. Security Council. But then there's also Kamala Harris, there's Lloyd Austin. I mean, what do you make of these African Americans holding public office right now?
موتناش الصاروخ بده يموتنا الجوع احنا بالنسبه لنا في الخيام مش عايشين عيشه بنادمين.
Well, these black faces in high places are there because
black faces in high places, is that
right? That's exactly. Black faces in high imperial places are there because of the struggles, the blood, sweat, and tears of everyday black people and other folk who joined the black freedom movement. Now they get there and they become rationalizers and justifiers of genocide, of ethnic cleansing. So again, it's hypocrisy. They become complicitous with American criminality. So the same thing with Obama. dropping drones on innocent people in Somalia and Pakistan and Afghanistan. You got seven wars going on at the same time, dropping 25,000 bombs a year and walking around with a Nobel Peace Prize. You see, that's just ridiculous.
But then, Doctor,
what happens to the legacies of Malcolm X and Martin King and Fannie Lou Hamer and Curtis Mayfield and John Coltrane? We can go on. Nina Simone. That tradition must be made highly visible. So it's not a question of what color you are, your skin pigmentation. It's a question of whether you have the courage to choose integrity, honesty, decency, seeking justice, and being willing to take the hits, being willing to pay the price, being willing to bear the burden.
But then you see how one could turn around, Dr. West, and be like, well, you're critical of all these public figures, but you yourself, you're running to be the head of this American empire, as you call it.
You're absolutely right. I'm running to be head of the American empire in order to dismantle the American empire, in order to disinvest from military and reinvest in the satisfaction of basic social needs of health care and housing and safe communities and quality education. And yes, I'm also running because I think the best of America, and the best of America is still America. The best of America is the Black freedom struggle. Is constituted by those Americans of all colors who have decided to opt for truth, justice, and love. And of course, that's the slogan of my campaign, right? Mm-hmm. Truth, condition of truth, choose allow suffering to speak, justice. Justice is what love looks like in public, and the courage that undergirds it, the willingness to cut against the grain. And I am an internationalist. That is to say, America does not have to be an empire. It must not be an empire. It must be one nation among nations. So that I believe that a baby in Ethiopia, in Guatemala, in Singapore, in New York, in Gaza, in Tel Aviv, they all have the same value. That's my egalitarian internationalism. And I'm deeply committed to that. And I think at this particular historical moment, as the American empire implodes, that the best of America ought to be part and parcel of the conversation, of the struggle. And I tell you this, my brother, well, we know Biden might run out of gas and give up. Trump may be on his way to jail, and we win. And when we win, I'm not going to the White House until every citizen has a house.
But what about those who are saying that, you know, this is a, you know, Cornel West, you're following in the footsteps of Ralph Nader, you know, that you're in 2024, that you're becoming basically, you could possibly be an enabler of Trump going into the White House.
No, I would say that each candidate has to win and earn their votes. 40% of Americans do not vote at all. I spend a lot of time with them.
But do they care about politics?
Well, a lot of times they either care and it's just given up because they know how rotten the system is, you know. Yeah. And sometimes they don't because they're just too busy. They're struggling, trying to survive and what have you. But the notion that somehow somebody can run for office, especially somebody who they know at the moment has much lower percentage, that they become the major or primary cause for the whole system. Right. That shows, again, the hypocrisy of it. If Biden can't make a case, he can't make a case. If Trump can't make a case, he can't make a case. People vote for each one of those because they think they made a case. They vote for me, they think I made a case.
Right.
Yet each candidate has to earn their votes. And of course, it could be the other way around too. They could be stealing from me. If you're going to use those kind of terms, I don't speak in those terms. I just think each candidate makes the case and people choose.
Right. My last question for you, Dr. West, I mean, you've been very outspoken for Gaza and for the situation on the ground. But again, how you know, obviously voicing support and all and calling for a ceasefire, it only goes so far. So how can you really say something or do something that implements change on the ground?
Well, all we can do is hit the streets. All we can do is go to jail. All we can do is put our bodies where our mouths are when we're not in the situation itself. But also on a very personal level, though, brother, we just want our precious Palestinian brothers and sisters to know that they feel so all alone. They feel as if the world doesn't care. They feel as if they are invisible. And we're out there every week to tell them, you are not invisible. We care and love you. We're concerned about you. And I say that to each and every oppressed group, be they in Sudan. I would have said the same thing to Jews in the 1930s. I've seen the same thing to black folk every day of my life. Same thing to indigenous people every week. You have to express yourself at that level of deep, deep moral and spiritual solidarity, because I don't have the political and economic power at the moment. But I can still raise my voice, and that's the anthem of black people. Lift every voice. Mm-hmm. And that voice is tied to a vision. And that vision is driven by a vocation. And that vocation is undergirded by the virtue of courage. And many of us would rather be dead than afraid. We'd rather be a corpse than a coward.
And on that note, Dr. Cornel West, I thank you so much for joining us on Real Talk Online. It's a real pleasure. And I wish you the best of luck with the campaign. I truly do.
I salute you, my brother. You stay strong. God bless your loved ones, man.
Thank you, Dr. West. Thank you so much.
And coming up next, we have British commenter Peter Oborn talking about the Labour Party and Gaza. Coming up, we have Peter Oborn, a British journalist and commenter, discussing the relationship between the Labour Party in the UK and the situation in Palestine.
A moral panic that radical Islam wants to take over this country is sweeping Britain. Started by Keir Starmer, inflamed by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, and it's been legitimised by the Speaker of the House of Commons. In order to dig themselves out of a hole over the cross-party support for Benjamin Netanyahu's operations in Gaza, there's no evidence at all that there's any basis, as matters stand, that this moral panic is true. What the protesters are doing over Palestine and Gaza is part of the rich British democratic heritage. The real attack on democracy here does not come from pro-Palestinian protesters. It comes from the Tory right and Starmer's Labour Party, who are trying to smear genuine protesters acting within the British tradition as extremists, and worse than that, violent extremists. So Keir Starmer is going to be Prime Minister, almost certainly. He has allowed an inflammatory account of events which, to be honest, puts at risk the lives of ordinary Muslims who will be accused of being part of this radical Islamist plot to sabotage the British Parliament. As for Sir Lindsay Hoyle, the Speaker, he was under fire personally for having given in to pressure from the Labour leader. How did he get out of it? Blame the Muslims.
I never, ever want to go through a situation where I pick up a phone to find a friend of whatever side has been murdered by terrorists.
He is conflating peaceful, democratic protest over Gaza with terrorist murder. This is very nasty politics. Just look at the headlines and the commentary in the newspapers.
A highly political, highly violent ideology called Islamism is sweeping our nation.
Every day, in every way, we cave in to Muslims, to Islamists.
And indeed, the extraordinary statements made in Parliament by Robert Jenrick, a former Conservative cabinet minister.
We have allowed our streets to be dominated by Islamist extremists.
This is very dark stuff. This is the politics of hatred.
I don't actually believe that these Islamists have got control. But what I do believe is they've got control of Khan, and they've got control of London.
The effect of the Speaker's actions has been to liberate the far right in British politics.
This is the direct result of irresponsible immigration policies from both Labour and Conservative governments over the course of the last 25 years. The encouragement of multiculturalism, to see fear stalking the corridors of Westminster, in the way that it is a deep international humiliation for our nation.
It's been portrayed as violent Islamists threatening British politics. It's actually mainstream British politicians pointing the finger at Muslims.
There's going to be a by-election in the next few weeks, and it could be a radical Islamic party winning that.
Is in one of these Midland urban areas that had
it's
the...
Rochdale. So it's an urban area in the north of England.
But it's the one that's had the rape situation?
Yes.
I think it's important to understand the fuller background. Last 4 to 5 months, both major parties have fully supported the Israeli invasion of Gaza and given Israel, or Benjamin Netanyahu, more precisely, carte blanche to do what he wants.
Israel has every right to defend itself.
Israel must have that, does have that right to defend herself.
The two main political parties haven't represented the British population. The vast majority want a ceasefire. Very few people want the war to go on. And the SNP, quite correctly, and within their democratic rights, put a motion for a ceasefire. For Starmer, it was potentially disastrous because it exposed huge divisions in his own party. And so there was rather an irregular meeting between the Labour leader and the leader of the House of Commons, in which Starmer said, look, we want to have a Labour motion. This was against precedent. The chief clerk in the House of Commons advised Starmer that he should not permit it, advised the Speaker it should not go ahead, but the Speaker accepted this personal plea from the Labour leader. And once that had happened, Starmer's political problem was solved.
I've made a judgment on a precedent that's been done before. I have viewed it as that is my ruling. And I'm going to stand by the ruling, and I'm not taking any more pound towards Ren O'Hara.
This then led to fury in the Commons.
Should the Labour Party's motion be carried, then the SNP's vote will not be held. Where on earth is the Speaker of the House of Commons?
So here we have the Speaker of the House of Commons under real pressure. Job is under threat. And what does he do? He goes in front of MPs and says he made his decision because he was concerned for the safety of MPs.
I apologise to the SNP. I have a duty of care that I will carry out to protect people. It is the protection that led me to make a wrong decision. But what I do not apologise is the risk that's being put on all members at the moment.
So this set in motion an immediate explosion of Islamophobic comment that these deranged Islamists were threatening parliamentary democracy. This was unacceptable. They were on our streets. And these claims by the Speaker, which were based on claims made to him by Starmer, were accepted without inspection. There's no evidence that has been produced. Very illustrative of what may have actually happened was a claim made by Scottish MSP Paul Sweeney. He said his office had been stormed by Gaza protesters and that his staff had been terrified. Glasgow police gave a very different story. They just said they were peaceful protesters, and all the evidence supports that account of events. Now, 30,000 people have been killed in Gaza, more than 10,000 children. And naturally, people feel very angry and upset that Britain is supporting the war. And not just Muslims, by the way. And so you have had demonstrations outside constituency offices, placards, chanting, I'm sure. But I think it's very important not to muddle up legitimate anger, which is part of being in a democracy, and physical threats, which, of course, are something else altogether. As it happens, I was one of the first journalists to raise the problem of security of MPs, which is a really serious issue. We know this because of the murder of Joe Cox by some sort of fascist. We know this because of the murder by a Muslim of David Amos, these terrible events when George Galloway was violently assaulted on a London street, hospitalised when he was MP for Bradford West. I think this was about 2014. At the time, not a single MP raised the issue. Burkow, the Speaker, had nothing to say. The press was silent, and I wrote a piece. This is very serious. An MP is being assaulted. As it happened, Galloway was assaulted because of his views on Israel. So there is a general threat, not just from Islamists, but from all sides to MPs, and we have to take it very seriously. But what I fear here, looks to me we have the weaponization by the two main political parties, aided and abetted by the Speaker, Lindsay Hoyle, the weaponization of these threats to MPs in order to discredit peaceful, maybe passionate, protesters against British government policy over Gaza. Bear in mind, we've had a practice run for the very frightening and troubling events of this week, and that was the attempt by Suella Braverman, when she was Home Secretary, to designate those marching in favour of a ceasefire in Gaza as what she called hate marches.
To my mind, there's only one way to describe those marches. They are hate marches.
Well, actually, they were acting in the long and very honourable tradition of British protest movements. Suella Braverman embodies a far-right movement deploying bigotry and hatred to disenfranchise many of our fellow citizens. There's a very big danger that this coming general election is going to be fought around the general narrative of the so-called Great Replacement Theory, which is a conspiracy theory that foreigners, especially Muslims, want to take over Britain and take over indeed the West and subvert our democracy. I think there's no doubt that the Tories will fight the election on this noxious narrative. And from the events of this week, you have to ask whether Sir Keir Starmer is preparing to follow suit. Keir Starmer is going to be almost certainly the next British Prime Minister, but judging by Sir Keir Starmer's behaviour this week, we really have reason to fear him as Prime Minister. He's shown such reckless judgment. He hasn't shown any understanding of what it means to be a statesman, a figure who can unite the nation rather than govern by creating fake divisions. As last week's events in Parliament show, the British media, as a general rule, do not interrogate statements made by British politicians. They do not hold politicians to account. Hence the real importance of supporting independent media like Double Down News. So join Double Down News on Patreon and read Middle East Eye, the outlet where I write a column.
This is Dr. Yasser Khan describing what he has seen in Gaza.
There are Israeli spy drones, but there's also quadcopter drones, which are the drones that are weaponized with missile or sniper fire. And there was constant humming. And right away, I noticed the bombs going. We're, at that point in time, they were about a kilometer away from the hospital. Now, of course, they're right there. And you could hear the bombs, and your whole body would shake. And the ER docs told me, they said, listen, Dr. Khan, you know what? Give it 10, 15 minutes. The mass casualties will start coming in. And boy, indeed, they did come in, George. And it was the most horrific scene that I've ever seen in my entire life. It was annihilation. It was mass chaos. I don't know if anybody can properly picture. It was mass chaos. There's people coming in with rubble, you know, women, mothers holding their children. This one mother was holding her 8-9-year-old boy, who, by the way, is skinny, like there's bones, because, as you know, they've been starved. I mean, they're starving now, and they've been starved intentionally by the Israeli forces, by the Israeli government, and they're starving, and they're all thin, and she's holding this cold, dead body, screaming to us to check her pulse, check his pulse, and the boy's cold and dead, and that's just one example. I mean, there's more than, I'd say about 60% of the people that I saw were all children, and all young children, under 13 or 14, I mean, not that, I mean, even a 17-year-old is young, but under 13 or 14, you know, covered with rubble, dust, head fractures. I mean, I hate to be graphic, but this is how it is, and what we should know. Limbs dangling off, barely connected, soft tissue wounds right to the bone, and, you know, eyeballs. Now, I do plastic eye surgery, eyeballs shattered with eye shattered shrapnel kind of extruding. And you saw all this in front of me. It was mass chaos. There is no space because it's already 300% over capacity. There's no gauze. Staff are overworked. There's children and women all over the floor. They had to suture whatever they could on the ground, on the floor, without anesthetic, because the anesthetic, local anesthetics are short supply. Trying to triage who goes up, who doesn't go up. You know, head trauma in 2-year-olds with sort of a bump filled with blood there. and just lying on the floor, forgotten in the mass chaos. And it was just horrific. It was, I always call it, it was like hell on earth, in my opinion.
We have to stand for what is right and what is just. And I think our loyalty, both, and I come out of a very strong Christian tradition, but I think both as Muslims and both as Christians, our loyalty is with the oppressed. We must always stand with the oppressed. And that's not practical, as you know. That's a moral imperative, and that makes us who we are. We will not abandon what the theologian James Cone called the crucified of the earth. And for me, first on that list is the Palestinian people.
And that was Chris Hedges. And this is a Palestinian singer. I'm sorry, I don't know her name, but this is the way I found it on the internet.
أنا العربي عربي عربي شوق يدفعني للقاها أرض الأقصى لا أنساها عشق أحلى من دمنا والروح أغلى قدسي 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 آهاتها أدمت عيناي صرخاتها باتت بلواي نصرك ربي لا تنسى أخاك فحماه حماك لا تنسى أخاك أنا العربي عربي عربي شوق يدفعني للقاها أرض الأقصى لا أنساها عشق أحلى من دمنا والروح أغلى قدسي 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 آهاتها أدمت عيناي صرخاتها باتت بلواي نصرك ربي